From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America, our topic on this edition of the program, Promoting Female Leadership. Our guest, Alice Nelson, she's president and CEO of Vital Voices Global Partnership. That's an international nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that invests in women leaders around the world who are at the forefront of creating a more sustainable and equitable future. Former First Lady and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton co-founded Vital Voices with the late Secretary of State Madeleine Albright in 1997. In early May 2022, Secretary Clinton participated in the grand opening of the new Vital Voices Global Headquarters for Women's Leadership in Washington, D.C., effectively the world's first global embassy for women. According to their press release, Vital Voices Global Partnership believes that women are the key to progress in their communities and that nations cannot move forward without women in leadership positions. The organization has invested in more than 20,000 women across 184 countries and territories over the past 24 years. Nobel Peace Prize laureates, U.S. Youth Poet laureates, prime ministers, and human rights activists are among leaders to whom Vital Voices provided early support. Co-founder of Vital Voices, CEO Alice Nelson, has worked for the organization for more than 22 years. Previously, she served as vice president and senior director of programs. She has spoken before the UN General Assembly, the Clinton Global Initiative, and Women in the World. Alice also conducts leadership training for women at governmental departments. She is the author of the best-selling book, Vital Voices, The Power of Women Leading Change Around the World. And Alice Nelson joins us via Microsoft Teams. Alice, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Carol. Thrilled to be here.
Well, we are thrilled to have you. And Alice, let's start from the beginning. Talk about your personal connection to Vital Voices. How did you get involved?
Absolutely. So back in 1995, I was a junior in college, and I heard about something called the United Nations Fourth World Conference on Women that was going to be held in Beijing, China. It was going to be the largest gathering of women ever in history. 55,000 women leaders were slated to gather the NGO Forum, which ran in parallel to the conference where 189 governments from around the world were going to meet to sign on to something called the Platform for Action to improve the lives of women in 12 areas from education, political participation, economic development, etc. Mind you, this is 1995, so you can't Google women's rights. There was not a lot of articles. There was not a lot of books back then about global women's issues. Certainly, I knew the rights that my grandmother's generation, my mother's generation had fought and won. Obviously, those same rights, quite frankly, under attack right now. But I knew so much of what had happened in this country, but there was very little information, at least that I could access in 1995, about what was happening for women around the world. I also, at the same time, knew that I would be of this rising generation of young people who would be part of this global economy, whatever that was. Right? The internet was just beginning. We called it the World Wide Web back then. So I heard about this gathering and I thought, okay, I've got to get there. I've got to find a way. And I applied for a visa. I sent in all my materials. I bought the cheapest ticket I could find, you know, five stopovers before landing in Beijing. I mean, I was a college student. And it was a transformative experience for me. I met women all over the globe who were working to make the world a better place, things that I didn't know about, like the issue of human trafficking. You know, modern day slavery was alive and well around the world, affecting almost every country. But yet there was very little news about this. There was no laws on the books. I learned about girls' education and how so many girls were kept out of school because of cultural norms of what girls were expected to do. So I got an immediate education in those 2 weeks that I spent surrounded by those 55,000 women. And I just felt ignited. I knew I wanted to be part of a solution in the world, because knowing that my generation of young people did not know the world that we were coming into, where so many rights that maybe we enjoyed in our country, maybe women did not have around the world. I think I became ignited. And on that very last day of the conference, I heard Hillary Clinton speak. She gave that very famous speech. She was then First Lady of the United States. Many people didn't want her to travel to China to speak at a human rights conference for women. They felt that would be giving too much to China. But she was extremely eloquent, and she was able to walk that line of being both diplomatic, but also calling out the Chinese government and other countries around the world where women's human rights were being violated, where girls had gone missing, you know, across Asia because of the one-child policy. And so she spoke, and I heard her as a young woman, and that was really my call to action. I went back to my university. I held a big gathering, and one of the people I invited was a woman named Teresa Lohr, who was then director of something called the President's Interagency Council on Women, based at the White House at that time, early 1996. And I hit it off, and she said, "You ought to come down and work for us. You know, you can work as an intern in the White House," implementing what Secretary Clinton signed on to and the U.S. government signed on to. Obviously, at that time, she was First Lady, to improve the lives of women in those 12 critical areas. So I immediately did that. I graduated from college. I head down to D.C. and interned at the White House. A couple of years later, after the work that we were doing to implement that platform for action into the U.S. government, working across all the various agencies, there was interest in looking at what we could do on a global level, how we could work with other governments, other countries, leaders. And my boss and I moved to the State Department to create the first ever global office for women's issues. And I was then able to get a job there at the State Department. And that's where the first Vital Voices Conference was held. In 1997, a very activist ambassador named Swanee Hunt came into our office and said, "You know, I want to hold a regional gathering of women from all over the former Soviet Union, Central and Eastern Europe." There obviously had been big changes afoot throughout the region with the fall of the former Soviet Union not too long before that. And she wanted to hold this gathering. And in 1997, so 25 years ago, the first Vital Voices Conference was held. And it was such a call to action for women around the world, women who were leading in their countries and communities and having an impact. They didn't think of themselves as leaders because they didn't have the maybe leader title, but yet they were having an impact. And what happened then when we returned from that conference, which quite frankly was supposed to be a one-off gathering, women leaders around the world started contacting our little office at the State Department and saying, "We want Vital Voices too. Can you bring it to our country, our community? We have women who are doing extraordinary things, but they're not being recognized. They aren't coming together." You know, and still, if you think about it, I think Google was founded in 1998. I just use that as a barometer because tools like Google, obviously later so social media, enabled us to connect around the world. And if you think about 1997, certainly 1995, there just wasn't that opportunity. And so in-person gatherings, conferences that brought people together were extremely valuable. I mean, if you can imagine, if you are a woman leader in Afghanistan who started a girls' school, you know, and the Taliban is pressing down on you to stop, if you meet another woman maybe in a village in Nigeria who has done something very similar, that is extremely empowering to you to know that you're not alone, that there are women around the world like you fighting the good fight, standing up for the rights of people. So Vital Voices really caught fire in the U.S. government. We started doing Vital Voices conferences and gatherings all over the world. It was a real means to channel resources, more foreign policy attention to the critical role that women played. And so it was a very exciting time because you had Madeleine Albright coming in as Secretary of State. You had a very activist, albeit informal, ambassador for global women's issues, Hillary Clinton, as First Lady at the time. And the two of them really sort of tag-teamed working on these issues, whether it be sort of behind closed doors meeting with other foreign ministers or heads of state or out among women leaders in their communities, in villages, as Secretary Clinton, then First Lady, was doing. They had this incredible partnership. And really, Vital Voices was born from that. First, as I say, at this one-off conference, but later that really turned into this ongoing initiative that was global. In 2000, a number of women leaders who had been part of Vital Voices conferences, some who had started Vital Voices chapters, who had been really inspired, basically said, look, you've got to continue this. You can't let it end when there's a change of administration. And so Vital Voices decided to become a nonprofit. And that was in 2000. And one of the things that we always say is that we were founded for and because of women leaders. We would not be if it wasn't for these inspiring leaders around the globe. And, you know, what we do now is we think of ourselves very much as venture catalysts. We are out there constantly searching for extraordinary women leaders who maybe, again, don't have the sort of title or they're not household names in their countries, but they are indeed making extraordinary change, improving people's lives, saving lives in their countries and communities, tackling the most critical issues that our world is dealing with today and solving those issues, whether it be the climate crisis or economic inequities. And we really invest in them. And what we do today is very different than what we did when we were first founded. When we were first founded, it was enough to bring women leaders together, acknowledge the critical role that they were playing. Today, you know, it isn't just about bringing them together, although that is still very powerful for women to have that sort of network of their peers. And now, as you said, it's 20,000 women large across 184 countries. But it is also very much about providing training, providing mentors, visibility and credibility for their work, whether that be through awards or media, financial support, tech support in some cases, and wellness as well. I think one of the things that we've come to realize is so many leaders come to this work from a personal experience, and sometimes it's a traumatic personal experience, and also providing that sort of wellness support that they need to also take care of themselves in addition to bringing everyone in their community along.
Alicia Nelson, thank you so much for that incredible description of the history of the organization to date. You answered a lot of questions that I had in that one answer. And of course, no, speaking of Hillary Clinton, we'll never forget that I believe she coined the phrase that women's rights are human rights. Mm-hmm. And as you rightly said, many of our rights that we took for granted are under attack today. So that underscores the importance of your organization, whether it's the women under the Taliban regime, women and girls going backwards, or even in our own country, reproductive rights that we more or less took for granted are under siege. But let me ask you now, in terms of the embassy that we have here in Washington, now the global headquarters, what value added does that embassy in Washington bring to your overall mission?
Sure. Well, I think, you know, look, we've been around now, as I said, for 25 years. And very few people, though, oddly enough, know about the work that we do. And a lot of that is because, quite frankly, we've done it behind the scenes, you know, supporting leaders like Malala Yousafzai after she was shot, helping her to incubate what is the Malala Fund today, right? But in those early days where she was still in the hospital fighting for her own life, that's where we had stepped in to provide support very much under her direction. But we have always worked very much behind the scenes because we have always wanted to put the women leaders that we're supporting and their bold ideas for change in the forefront. So I think part of this is about coming out from behind the curtain, which I think, quite frankly, is so critical right now because people need to know that, yes, women can organize and march in the streets, and that's extremely important to protest so that people can visually see us. But I think that a global embassy gives us a sense, not just Vital Voices, but quite frankly, this whole movement for women's rights and women's leadership, a real place of permanence. And I think that that's important. We are on 16th Street in what the mayor has now coined the Equality Corridor. You've got Black Lives Matter right down the street. You've got the Human Rights Campaign building, which really was a signal and a huge visible support for the LGBTQI plus community. When it first came around, that was maybe 15 years ago. But I think that it's important to have monuments and places that are spaces for women. You know, you think about monuments around the world, I think it's something like only 6% are, you know, named for women. And obviously women have done a lot more than 6% of the leadership over our history in this country and around the world. So having spaces that are named for women, places for women to gather, that are known, that are public, and that are prominently positioned at the seat of power.
Absolutely. We're going to take a short break and we'll be right back. You're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is Elise Nelson, President and CEO of Vital Voices Global Partnership. The organization recently opened a global headquarters in Washington, D.C. to promote women's leadership. I'm Carol Castiel, and please note we have moved our programs to a new website, voaafrica.com. From voanews.com. You can find us on voaafrica.com/PCUSA. You can also follow us on Twitter and connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel VOA. Well, here's a shout out to a loyal Twitter follower, Nixon Wangale from Bungoma, Kenya. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, send an email to PCUSA@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page and follow us on Twitter. Well, back to our guest, Elise Nelson. And Elise, I think you have said that women lead differently. So I'd like you to describe, how is it that women lead differently than men, generally speaking?
Yeah. And I think, you know, what you just said, generally speaking, is important, because I think that what we're seeing is the rise of more sort of female leadership qualities and traits, and that those are the things that are very much needed in the world. But it doesn't mean that men don't and can't utilize and thrive using those same traits. And certainly they do. So one thing that we began to see, I guess, about 15 years into our work. So back in 2012, 10 years ago, I wrote a book that really talked about some of the findings that we'd seen around the world. We had at that stage worked with more than 10,000 women leaders across probably about 150 different countries. And what we began to see, whether it was a peace activist in Northern Ireland or a graffiti artist using graffiti to raise awareness about the issue of violence against women, we began to see that across all these cultures and languages and differences, socioeconomic backgrounds, that there were these common traits or practices that really successful women leaders were employing. And these were things that were just coming naturally to them. It was not something that was learned from some sort of leadership course. And so we started to call them out. And one of the reasons we started to call them out is because we felt if more women could understand the way this woman is leading and this woman is leading, she would in fact see herself as a leader. And so many of the women that we were working with maybe didn't have the sort of leadership title. They maybe weren't born into the right family, you know, that was the family that was to lead, but yet they were leading. They were impacting the lives of others in a positive way. And so we basically called out these five traits. And the first is really this driving force or sense of mission. We found that so many of the women we were working with had a personal experience that led them on the leadership path. They experienced something in their community. They saw a wrong. They made a choice to step up and right it. So many women leaders that we work with will say, I made a choice. I saw something. I couldn't look away. I made a choice to step up and do something about it. Now, this is, again, why they often didn't see themselves as leaders. They would say, oh, I'm just a woman who gets up every day and does the right thing, right? Well, that is a core trait of leadership, right? That you see the wrong and you step up to right it. It's very passion-driven. It was very cause-driven. So that really set them on the path, having that true north and a very strong idea of what they were fighting for. The second thing we found is that these leaders had tremendous empathy, which, of course, back then was not seen as a core trait of leadership, that they could understand the people that they were leading. They went in listening rather than talking. They spent time in communities. They would go into communities, listen to people, and then reflect their voices in the halls of parliament or wherever it might be. But they had that deep sense of compassion, and that indeed they were leaders really to fight for, to support, to amplify others. The third thing that we found is that they could easily put their ego aside and work with people who maybe they didn't agree with. And we really talked about this as the power to cross lines that typically divide us. So that could be, you know, in a peace building process, it could be in the halls of parliament and in politics, of crossing those party lines, religious lines, those things that typically tend to divide, that they could say, well, you know, maybe we disagree on 90% of things, but we can agree on this thing, that we want a better future for our families. We're not going to worry about who gets credit, and we're going to push forward on this issue. And we need leaders like that, right? Because we know that, you know, you can make change, but it's only really sustainable change if you can get that broad coalition of people from diverse backgrounds to agree upon something. The fourth thing that we found, and we call these practices because, you know, in leadership, you're never done, right? You're never at the end of your path. You're constantly taking inputs from those people that you're leading. And that is very important to think about it as a practice. And so this fourth area is really around this idea of bold ideas and bold action, that we would find leaders around the world who were using really sort of innovative ways of making change. And everybody was saying to them, well, that's crazy. It'll never work. It's never been done that way. But guess what? That issue had also never been solved. Maybe it was violence against women. Maybe it was, you know, how do we engage men and working on these issues? But they were coming up with these really innovative, unheard of solutions. And they were working. And so it's very much the concept of doing something different. You know, maybe your gut is telling you this is the way, and really believing and trusting in that difference. And knowing that, quite frankly, I think historically, we know women have been left out of decision-making tables, and really thinking about, okay, the value of having been left out is that often you are closest to the problems and you can only really tackle and solve the challenges that you experience personally. And so, you know, trusting in those who maybe haven't been at decision-making tables, but who have been the closest to the problems to solve them. And then finally, what we found again and again is that women had this resolve to pay it forward. They were invested in, they were supported, maybe by us, maybe by their communities. And they immediately thought about, okay, who do I share this with? Who do I reach out to? And so, you know, seeing statistics now that bear this to be true, which is that women will reinvest in others when they are invested in, whether it be financially, whether it be training, whether it be mentoring. There is a higher probability that they will share that with others and sort of spread the wealth. So those are the five core practices and lessons that we learned from women around the world. And I do believe that women lead differently. I have seen it firsthand again and again and again. And it's not about a country, a community, a culture, a religion. There is something different that women bring. But I think as more women get into positions of leadership, you know, become the bosses of men, become mentors of young men, I think that you begin to see more and more men taking on these traits. And I think people recognizing these are the traits that we need to solve some of these intractable challenges. It is new thinking, collaborative thinking, empowerment thinking, and driven by the challenges that we face, not driven by power for the sake of power, but driven by power for the sake of empowering others and the issues that we care about and need to solve as a collective community.
Absolutely. Empathy, consensus building, paying forward, as you say, mentoring others are extremely important among all the other qualities and traits you underscored. We don't have a lot of time, Elise, so let me get you to talk briefly about the structure, priorities, and financing of Vital Voices. How do you get your funding? What is the role of the councils, chapters? I know you have programs that revolve around important themes like gender-based violence, climate justice, economic empowerment, women, peace, and security, and political and policy advocacy, all extremely important areas where women need to get involved. But what about the role of councils, fundraising, global chapters? If you could address that, that would be great.
Sure. So as I mentioned, I mean, Vital Voices was created for and because of women leaders. And so our structure has always, I think, amplified and lived that mission in real time. So we gain our funding from individuals, governments, private sector, foundations. It really is a collective source. There are certainly organizations that we will decide not to take money from because maybe our values are not aligned. And certainly that is a decision that we take very seriously. But we have a wide range of donors and supporters. And, you know, it's always so inspiring to see what a young girl in a community gets inspired by our mission and decides to do some fundraising activity locally and then sends it to us, you know, earmarked for the work we do with Afghan women leaders or the support that we're providing in country for women and children internally displaced inside Ukraine. So in terms of how we are structured, we have Vital Voices chapters around the world that women leaders founded as a result of going to our gatherings and getting excited and wanting to bring sort of the seeds of Vital Voices home to their countries and communities. We also have Vital Voices councils. Councils are throughout the United States. We also have a council in Europe. And what they do is more raise awareness, raise financial support, and also help us to identify and engage future members of our network that might participate in our programs. Typically the way that women come into the Vital Voices network, because it is important to understand that we don't do one-off conferences. We are big believers in supporting leaders. And so typically a woman will come into one of our fellowship programs. Most of them are about a year long, both in-person and online training. And then they're really part of the network. They've got a cohort of maybe 30 other women leaders that they're going through the program with. But then they join this larger network of 20,000 plus women leaders around the globe. And as members of the network, they can, yes, start a Vital Voices chapter, although we don't necessarily encourage that because a lot of times there are organizations already in their communities that exist, and we don't want to reinvent the wheel. It's really there for if there is no mechanism to bring women leaders together in their country to support each other, then Vital Voices chapter could potentially be a good tool for them. But it's not something that is always needed. We have network members, as you know, across 184 countries. But our network is very active. We have a global network hub where we coordinate all kinds of different activities. We have a Vital Voices global mentoring walk that we do every year in March. And we've had as many as 180 walks all over the globe in different cities. But also, you know, one of the things that I think our network does very well is that when a woman is in crisis, they support each other. And Vital Voices has a crisis initiative, which is newer to the work that we do, but I think necessary. You know, quite frankly, we're living in a world where it's rise of refugees, the rise of environmental crises. Women are definitely disproportionately impacted anytime a country is in crisis. The Crisis Fund provides emergency assistance, financial assistance, and support, but also really solidarity with that larger network.
Let's say I'm a female in Nigeria, Uganda, Kenya, maybe even Senegal, and this is the first time I'm hearing about Vital Voices, at least through this interview. What would be the first step to try to get involved and get more information?
Well, if you go to our website, vitalvoices.org, O-R-G, almost on a regular basis, you can find opportunities to sign up, to apply, to be part of our various fellowship programs. I cannot recommend them highly enough. If there isn't a fellowship that meets your current needs, we also have the Vital Voices Leadership Journey. And that is the 7-week course. It's all online. It isn't as big of a year-long commitment, but it will introduce you to the leadership practices and principles that I mentioned earlier. So that's a great way to get involved. And we're always taking in new cohorts there. Lastly, you can certainly sign up for our newsletter that goes out twice a month, really keeping you up to date with everything that's going on across our global network, but also more broadly on these issues. And come the fall, we're going to be having a slew of regular programming within our building, and also bringing online a digital twin to the building so that you don't have to be in Washington, although you're welcome when you're in town, but you can participate online as well. And we'll have regular programming and all kinds of exciting activities. So one of the goals of really having this global headquarters and the digital twin to the global headquarters was really to expand our model and the lessons we've learned. Because what I'm convinced of now more than ever is that our our world needs more leaders who have a vision for positive change. And I think we need to tap more women leaders.
Elise Nelson is the CEO and president of the international nonprofit Vital Voices Global Partnership. And congratulations, Elise, on the global embassy that opened this year. And thank you for your time and terrific insights.
Thank you, Carol.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Rick Pantaleo. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.